Mike Miller often joins us here on WGN Radio, an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. And not infrequently when he joins us, he ends up saying something like, "You're not going to want to hear this, John. Today may be another one of those days." Michael Miller, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing very well, John. Thank you for inviting me.
Stop laughing. So let's just talk a little bit about minimum wage. What happens when, in order to help low-wage workers, we impose a higher minimum wage? We're all trying to figure out how it is to get people to go back to work. What's the research on this?
Well, the research shows in general that minimum wages do not raise the incomes of people that they're intending to help, except for those very few that keep their job. And it does not add to employment. In fact, if anything, it reduces it, though not very much. But there's a very interesting piece that came out that was focused upon the minimum wage that is paid to people who earn tips at restaurants and so forth. As many people know, if you're a tipped worker, you have a different minimum wage. It could only be like a couple dollars an hour. As long as your wage plus your tips equals the minimum wage, then you're paid fairly. So what some localities have tried to do is to try to make these tipped workers receive the same minimum wage as everybody else. And the intention, of course, would be when you add that to the tips, these people would make more money. And unfortunately, the research showed that that simply did not happen. A very respectable economist out of California, David Newmark, did a study, and he found that after you compare various workers across locations, those who have tips, those who don't, that once they tried to raise the wage for the workers who are tipped, at the end, when it was all over, employment fell slightly and incomes did not rise. So
why is that?
I could ask you, if you go into a restaurant, now I tend to be a relatively heavy tipper because I think these people work hard and they don't make a lot of money. Knew that they're being paid the same as people who, the regular wage, then I think I would probably tip less so that the overall income that the person has at the end of the day would not be higher. Now, maybe would you continue to tip if you knew that they were being paid more?
Well, if you're asking me that question, I don't know. I suppose in the back of my mind, if I knew that's what had happened, maybe I wouldn't tip 30% and I'd tip 19 or 22%. But still, are you telling me that for that reason alone, the wage doesn't go up and people, because of a higher minimum wage, tend not to make more money? Is that what happens, Michael?
Well, it's a combination of two things. One would have to do with how much people are willing to tip. The second one is how many hours do you get? So what we have found in many cases, in some research that was done regarding Seattle from the University of Washington and so forth, that people will earn more per hour for each hour they work. But in many, many cases, they will end up working fewer hours, and therefore their total take-home pay at the end of the day mm-hmm. is either no more, maybe slightly higher, but in some unfortunate cases, it's actually somewhat lower. And so it's a combination of things, because we got to remember that people do respond to incentives. And if I know that someone is being compensated fairly, I will be much less likely to try to throw a few extra bucks into the till so that they have something something that they earn at the end of the day.
I understand that. You're less incentivized, though they may be, to go to work. So why aren't they working as much? Is it because the employers cut their hours or because they're satisfied with what they're making?
Now, the research has not been perfectly clear on that, but from the way I've read it or my understanding of it, it is a combination of the two. That certain people that are in these kinds of jobs, they actually are working part-time because it fills in a hole that they need and they have to earn a certain amount of money to make the household go. And once they've earned that amount of money, they will then draw back on their own hours because they have earned sufficient dollars to meet their spending needs. And in some other cases, you will find that they simply get fewer hours. Mm-hmm. There'll be fewer hours that would be related to overtime and things like that.
Well, here's where we are, Michael. I'll pause this conversation in just a minute with you, and then we'll finish it after we do some business reports. But I got a text message from a listener today who said he and his colleagues are in a disagreement about whether or not McDonald's should pay a quote-unquote living wage, $15 an hour or more. My listener said it should be $10 or less because you should not be counting on that as a living wage. Well, $10 or $15 an hour, I said, it doesn't matter. They're not doing it anyway. And I have a little less sympathy maybe than I should because I'm not a business owner for the businesses, because now the power is in the employees' hands. And for some reason, people are not being incentivized to work for what you're paying them. The solution is not to yell at these people. I mean, you can, but the solution is only going to come when the employers decide to make it more attractive to go to work.
I fully agree with that, you know, because work is going to be this mutual agreement between the worker and the employer, and there has to be some connection between the value that the worker brings to the table and the pay that they receive. At least that's what economic theory tells us. And I did, you know, and workers have very little power to negotiate with the boss. There often can be times where the pay will be lower than what they bring to the table, their value to the firm. And I think now this is a chance for workers to negotiate and to say, I'm simply not coming unless you pay me something that matches what I think is, you know, my value to this firm and what I bring to the table and the money that you earn from my work. And I think that's wonderful. I think that negotiating between the workers and the employers to try to find a wage that is one that works for both sides is the way to do it, better than trying to impose a wage by the government.
We'll pause here. It does make one wonder if maybe this is employees who long felt underappreciated, and now they're just holding their breath. A moment ago, we talked to Michael about minimum wage and how sometimes increasing it actually decreases the amount of money some people make. You also shared with our producer, Pete, Michael, a graph that shows what's been happening with the Delta variant. Talk a little bit about that. What is this?
Oh, yeah, that was, you know, when you, if you looked at forecasts for the American economy this past summer, before the Delta variant had become so prevalent, we were expecting the third quarter into the fourth quarter to be the strongest quarters of the year, with growth which was way above potential, very strong. Employment would be rising and unemployment would be falling. And then the Delta variant hit. And, of course, we were not surprised. It has not affected manufacturing very much at all, and housing is still doing okay. But the area that was hurt during the pandemic is the area being hurt again by this this new variant, and that's restaurants and eating establishments and so forth. And after months and months of very strong growth in those areas where people were being hired instead of hours being reduced or people being laid off, all of a sudden, people are not going to restaurants in the same numbers, and restaurants are beginning to lay people off again. And it's discouraging. You know, you think we're done with the pandemic. Everybody takes the masks off and employment's getting back to normal. And then we get hit again. So it's just discouraging, but it's not a surprise that manufacturing remains strong because they can do that work and people are still buying those particular items. But the one area that's hurt are the ones where you can simply not buy the thing during the pandemic or during this variant, and you will never replace it. It's not like one thing we'll see, for example, that manufacturing will remain strong because even if you don't go out to buy a washer or dryer today, you're going to need that washer and dryer in the future. So you eventually will go and buy it, so they need to make it. But if you miss a restaurant meal this week because you're afraid of the variant, that's gone forever. And those people, you know, when that gets into the millions of people who are staying home, employment is going to fall. So it's discouraging to see that happening.
Economists study human nature. I wonder what we will have learned about the decision to roll into phase five when we did, knowing that with the Delta variant coming up and people's lack of compliance, say, with vaccines, that we were going to hit this second wave. I wonder then if it was the right decision to let us demask and go liberal like that.
Yeah, you know, that's a really You're speaking like an economist now, because oftentimes things, when you're living through them, they'll appear one way, and then when you finally study them after that, you know, for the sake of history, you'll be able to make a very reasoned evaluation of whether or not it was the right decision. I think people did not realize how virulent this particular strain is, that it can affect so many people so easily and it can be so quickly spread. I think that's the thing that has hurt it, and people hear that. And even if they are, just like, I'm vaccinated, and people tell me that I can still get this variant because it is so, it is such a problem. And that could lead some people who are immunocompromised and so forth to simply stay home. And we're seeing it in the macroeconomic data.
But Michael, if the reason that the Delta variant has spiked is not just because it's more virulent, but because people won't take the vaccine, I wonder if the Dr. Allison Arwoodies of the world should have anticipated that, or the economists advising the mayor, and they would say, listen, Governor, for instance, J.B. Pritzker, it's okay today for us to take the masks off, but I know a little something about people, and they're not going to take the vaccine. 30% of them are just not going to take the vaccine, and therefore we're going to have this new wave. If you want to, say, protect the economy or our health, you actually have to keep us in phase four. That's 2020.
Yeah.
But maybe those people should have had that foresight.
That's possible. But the one thing that, at least how I understand it, just reading it as a layman, is that even people who are vaccinated can get this particular variant. And so we really thought, I thought when I got the jab, the two of them, I thought, okay, I'm set. I don't have to worry about getting the disease. And if under some strange thing I did, I know it would be very mild. But the number of people who have been vaccinated who are actually getting it is surprisingly high. And I think that's the thing that they could not see or foresee. So in my mind, they probably made the right decision based upon the data they had at the time.
At the time. Yeah. We've also noticed that as the data changes, sometimes the consequences do too. So restaurant industry visits are down in August, and I guess we know why. Michael, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for giving us some of your time and, as always, your expertise today.
It's been my pleasure, John. Great talking to you.
Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul. It's John Williams here. And on the line is Eldon Scott, president of Urban Space. UrbanspaceCHI.com is the website for this new food hall that's opening. Maybe another one down the road, too. Let's start with the first one. Eldon, you're on WGN. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Talk to me about the concept. So what is urban space? What is a food hall?
A food hall is really a collection of local chefs that have some level of elevated food that are brought together in one place. And that's really it. It's pretty simple, but it creates a real sense of community and a lot of variety in different types of cuisine.
I want to talk about those. This will be at Washington and State. It's 12,000 square feet and in historic space. Is it opened? Is it just now opening? Where are you on that?
We're on our third day. And, you know, frankly, it's the first time I've seen pre-COVID traffic in a business district. We're super excited about the results so far.
Yeah, that's what it is, too. I mean, if you think the financial district, the jewelry district, if you think about downtown, a short walk from Willis Tower, or rather Sears Tower, or it's not Sears Tower, or Union Station, I guess this would be where you're drawing from, right?
Yeah, we're drawing from, the whole business district and the shopping. I think that the Loop and business districts in general really need these amenities to come back so that, you know, workers will be coming back and shoppers come back, and we're seeing that really start to tick up.
So what kind of vendors or restaurants or bars are at urban space?
We have, a number of great local chefs from Chicago, like Bumi, which is a new Indian concept, Edzo's, Bud Long. And we also brought three chefs from New York. We have Roberta's Pizza, which is one of the most famous pizzas in Brooklyn. Plant Junkie, which is a plant-based burger concept, and Pita Euro, which is a really fantastic Greek vendor. So it's something for everyone, really.
Do you sort of, I don't know, curate this, or is it just whoever we can get? Did you look for a certain blend and certain types of restaurants in urban space?
Yeah, no, it's heavily curated, and we have categories that we want to hit. And it's, I have to say, even I was really impressed with the food. It's just delicious. I mean, I kind of overate during the opening, but it's really, really good.
Well, that's the idea. So what is this New York pizza from Brooklyn about? Pete, my producer, was saying that's pretty famous. Fill us in.
Yeah, I mean, they started in Brooklyn, you know, 15 years ago, and it's just a staple. And we really wanted to see how Roberta's would go up against the Chicago pizza, and so far, so good.
Is it a deep dish? It is a square cut? What's the deal?
It's like a Neapolitan with a thin crust. Really, really good.
I'm sure it is. But hey, mister, that's not how we eat pizza around here. You think you're going to make a go of that? What's the matter with you?
Well, you got to come try it.
Happy Lobster, I presume, is lobster rolls seafood?
Yeah, and they it's amazing because I'm actually originally from the East Coast, and I eat a lot of lobster rolls. And they have put these peppers in. It's something called the Angry Lobster Roll. And it is amazing. It's got a little kick to it, and it's just perfect.
So obviously this is in a business district, but anybody in the city of Chicago wondering where I want to eat, do I want pizza, you want a burger, he wants a salad, this is the kind of place you might gravitate to. And it's an interesting area anyway. We're at Washington and State we're talking about. 12,000 square feet. What's the building it's in?
It's just a commercial building that's right across from Daly Plaza. So it's just a great location because you've got Macy's diagonally across the street and lots of shopping and all the law firms and businesses, you know, that are down there. So it's just a great spot.
When did you put this into the works, and how much of a gamble is this, or maybe a measure of confidence from you that you're going to be successful here, what with the pandemic and all?
We were planning this before the pandemic, and obviously we were put on hold. But we, you know, we're very confident. We have 10 new food halls, two in Chicago and eight in other cities that we're moving forward with. It's really a great time to invest and get the kinks out, you know, as you're preparing for what we see to be a big recovery that's coming. I mean, neighborhoods are already back. And it's a question of when do these office districts really, really kick off.
I suppose, too, if it's a food hall, as I would imagine it, it's not tight quarters. It's probably a spacious area. I will feel comfortable eating indoors in these places.
Yeah, one of the things we found, even during the depths of the pandemic, was that there weren't a lot of, you know, places to kind of go casually, that had a lot of space in them. So the food halls do serve that. One of the things we like to say is, we, you know, make public space a little more private and private space a little more public. And you can just kind of come in and wander around, and there is plenty of space and not feel committed. It's essentially kind of fast casual, but the food's really good. So it's this great combination of an awesome space to hang out in and then a variety of different chefs to choose from.
I suppose from a business standpoint, too, this gives these restaurants a way to operate without some of the hiring concerns that a lot of them have. I mean, they're not staffing an entire restaurant. They're staffing a kitchen and a shared space.
Yeah, yeah. No, it. You know, I think that the food hall model works well with the new kind of reality that restaurants are facing, because you can lower staff costs, you can share marketing costs. And it's you can create more of a destination by putting a whole number of great restaurants together in one spot. So it's worked out well. We've seen over time, because we've been doing this for many years, the better chefs that would not have gone into this kind of fast casual environment are much more interested and willing to do it than they were, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah. There's a cocktail bar. There's a beer booth. There are 12 restaurant vendors. at this new place. If you're coming downtown Chicago for shopping or work or just for fun, 15 West Washington, just tap that into your little Google search. It's in the Loop. It's across from Macy's and Daly Plaza, 15 West Washington. It's called Urban Space. Well, nothing but good luck to you, Eldon. I hope that you are leading the charge back downtown. You're in the right place, sir.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Eldon Scott is the president at Urban Space. You can look him up, urbanspacechi.com. 1244, Ryan Burroughs got more business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based United Airlines says it will allow customers more flexibility to rebook travel by helping them find and use travel credits. Those credits will now be displayed during the checkout process for Mileage Plus members. Also beginning next week, United will let customers use travel credits for extra legroom seats and to prepay for checked baggage. The Chicago Children's Museum is kicking off a new exhibit sponsored by Moen. The Moen Presents Water City will replace the Waterways exhibit, which has been featured at the museum for more than 25 years. The new exhibit comes as part of a grant by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and a matching donation from Moen, and it will connect water play and STEM experiences for kids and their families. Apple users will soon be able to upload their coronavirus vaccination cards via the Wallet app. Apple will allow users to show proof of vaccination through a QR code, but to protect users' privacy, full details of the vaccination card won't be visible until the user unlocks their phone. I'm Ryan Burrow. That's your Wintrust Business Minute.
With the business of food, Steve Alexander.
It's a Mr. Fizz Friday, but the Mr. went apple picking in Wisconsin. Jim is in Orion's old stopping grounds, the Kickapoo Valley, to load up on the local apples, so he'll check in with us on Monday. It is the final day of the National Farm Safety and Health Week. Women are the focus today, so who better to talk to than a farmer who's a woman?
Well, so far, I'm mostly healthy.
And mostly tired.
Yes, it's been a very long days.
Jenny Sauer-Schmigdahl is about to start harvesting corn and soybeans on the family farm she and her dad run near Winchester in west central Illinois. And these days leading up to harvest have been all about getting their combine cleaned and greased and oiled and all checked over.
We're doing a little bit more than we used to, just to make sure.
And just to make sure that their John Deere combine, a 36,000-pound beast with thousands of parts, is up to the task of 14-hour days for 4 weeks in a row.
Got to keep going. So if it's not raining, you're out there.
Yeah, but think of all that overtime pay. Oh, yeah, the fate of the family farmer. There is no overtime pay, but
it's okay, because I love what I'm doing, even if I'm tired.
Plenty of reasons for her to be tired, including at the end of the day, she's got a toddler at home.
Oh, yes, yes. My daughter will turn 2 at the end of next month, so that adds a whole extra level of stress.
Her hope for all farmers this harvest? Be safe. Don't be in a rush. Take the time necessary for safety, and
get some sleep. If you don't get sleep, you're not thinking clearly.
Jenny Sauer-Schmigdahl, you can follow her farming activities on Twitter. The Witty Farmer is her handle. Here we go. After Chicago Board of Trade, soybeans are up about a penny and a half. Corn right now is down a penny and a half. And wheat is, up about 5.5 cents. From the farm to your belly today, it is National Cherries Jubilee Day. I think that's the one they set on fire, isn't it? That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Neil DeGia is a general manager for Canopy Hotels and the Hotel Garden Inns. CanopyByHilton.com is the website, and there's a new, hotel would be the way to describe it, opening up in Chicago. Let's talk a little bit about this business. Hi, Neil. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hi, guys. Hi, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's exciting.
It's a very exciting time for our project and our properties, so I look forward to chatting with you about it.
Well, let's do that. You guys just opened up. You're, a day old in the city now?
It is. Yeah, our opening happened yesterday. So we are actually 2 brand new Hilton properties in 1 historic building in a landmark destination. So as you said, our hotels are the Hilton Garden Inn Chicago Central Loop and the Canopy Chicago Central Loop. And what's unique about our project is that our building was built in 1904 and used to be the old Chicago Northwestern Railway offices. We're also located directly across the street from the Willis Tower. It's a great location if you want to, attend or go to a show or the Art Institute of Chicago, Millennium Park, Chicago Riverwalk. They're all within walking distance.
How would you describe these properties?
So the Hilton Garden Inn Chicago Central Loop is an upscale select service hotel brand. I'm sure you've seen and you're familiar. And what we're really excited about is the Canopy by Hilton, which is Hilton's branded boutique hotel. And the Canopy brand is really designed to invite the city and ensure guests have a positive stay and enjoy the best of the neighborhood. So we're really excited about that property. That'll be opening actually in early November. So the Hilton Garden opened up last night, and Canopy is going to be in November.
When you say boutique, I think smaller, I think quainter. I don't think a giant dining or maybe gathering space, but maybe a smaller bar, maybe even smaller rooms, like a European hotel. Is it that or is it something else?
Yeah, you pretty much. So boutique property. So what's unique about our space, actually, so I mentioned the Chicago Northwestern Railway offices. So the design of the property is actually going to it's actually transporting you into the early 1900s. So yeah. When you walk into our lobby and our restaurant, you're going to feel like you're in an old train car and be transported again, like early 1900s in Chicago. Our guest rooms will actually, remind you of what like an old train car looks like. So it's definitely a unique experience and definitely a unique property.
And probably a smart location, too. I mean, because you described shopping, Millennium Park, the businesses downtown, the governmental offices downtown. So it seemed to me like you can draw from a whole host of possible occupants. I presume the tourist or just the traveler is one of them as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we're next door to or across the street from the Willis Tower, and there's a lot of activity that goes around this area and this neighborhood, during the day and at night. So it's nice to see folks walking around enjoying the weather, we look forward to inviting them to our properties here soon.
You know, I just talked to Eldon Scott, who's the president of Urban Space. I don't know if you heard part of that conversation, but he is one of your neighbors downtown, and he's just opened up a new food hall in Chicago, including a pizza joint from New York and then a bunch of places that Chicagoans may be familiar with. But the idea is come downtown. Downtown is opening up, is going to be at capacity again someday. But one also has to believe that there's a little bit of a risk on your part, Neil. I mean, how long do you go with this before you decide if it was successful?
Well, all I know, John, is that, we keep improving. You know, we're in a better position, than we were in 2020. And yeah. Each and every month, occupancies and rates, continue to increase. So, there are a lot of positive signs out there that, travel is somewhat back. Conventions and groups are starting to book again. So I'm fairly confident that, we don't necessarily know what it's going to look like today, tomorrow, or, a few months down the road. But certainly there are some positive signs and of improvement. And so we'll take it.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you are where you are. You can't change that. So let's plow forward. What does a room cost? What are the rates range?
So our rates are going to range anywhere from, $200 up, and up, just depending on the time period. We're actually, approaching a busy weekend. So you'll probably find our rates anywhere from $300 to $350. So again, it just depends on the time frame because, during our slower season, we certainly might offer some, discounted rates. But as of right now, our rates are anywhere from $200 to $350.
Well, for the first time ever, I'm cheering on high rates. I hope you get it. I hope you're at capacity because those are not 2020 numbers, sir. So
no, they certainly aren't. And so we're excited about that.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you, Neil. Continued success. Let's check in the near future and see how things are going. We wish you well.
We'd love to have you. So let me know. We'd love to have you as a guest, John.
Neil DeGuia is the general manager at the Canopy Hotel and the Hilton Garden Inn. CanopyByHilton.com to find out more.